From the Department of Surgery at the University of Wisconsin, welcome to the Surgery Set. I'm Jonathan Kohler, an assistant professor of pediatric surgery here in Madison. If you're just joining the podcast, every week we explore innovations and ideas in our department, and we meet really great people. Also, you should know, a set is the home of a badger. We're excited for you to join us. Our guest today is Ron Herschel. He's the Arnold G. Koren Collegiate Professor of Pediatric Surgery, and he's the head of the section of pediatric surgery at C.S. Mott Children's Hospital at the University of Michigan. He's also a giant in the field of pediatric surgery, and as a pediatric surgeon, it's a particular pleasure to be able to speak with him today. Dr. Herschel holds numerous grants in amazing fields. He's an incredibly accomplished researcher and surgeon, one of the pioneers of ECMO, and an active researcher as well as an active clinician. He spoke to us today about the making of a surgeon, and we're going to talk a little bit about that. But Dr. Herschel, first, welcome to the Surgery Set, and thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us today.
Thank you, Jonathan. Pleasure to be here.
Before we dive into the substance of your talk, which is available online for people to see, I just wanted to talk, and tomorrow you're going to be speaking to the pediatricians here, and I think that video will also be available. And I just can't not talk about some of the research that you've done on liquid ventilation and artificial lungs. I mean, it's like science fiction come to life, some of the work that you've done. Can you tell us a little bit about sort of your research interests and what you're doing in the lab?
Sure. So we did, for many years, the 1990s and through about 2010, did a lot of work both in the laboratory as well as in the clinical setting around liquid ventilation and especially in the treatment for ARDS and various aspects of lung failure. Actually used it in patients on ECMO and eventually in patients with respiratory failure that were not on ECMO, all the way from newborns to children to adults. And it had its areas of effectiveness. And in fact, our most recent studies in the last few years have been around growing lungs with perfluorocarbon in patients with congenital diaphragmatic hernia. So it still continues to be an area of research and an area of interest. There are two types. One is partial liquid ventilation, where we take the perfluorocarbon and put into the lungs and gas ventilate the perfluorocarbon-filled lung, and total liquid ventilation, where we fill the lungs with perfluorocarbon and then use something similar to a ventilator or an ECMO machine to oxygenate the perfluorocarbon, remove carbon dioxide, warm it, and pump it into and then out of the lungs. And clinically, we explored the first one, but we have not had the chance to explore the second one, which has a great deal of promise. My other area of interest is in ECMO, and currently I am working a number of different projects, but one of the main ones is the development of an artificial lung for pediatric patients with chronic respiratory failure. So what would that look like? Let's take the example of a baby with diaphragmatic hernia that has hypoplastic lungs and pulmonary hypertension and is either stranded on ECMO or we know will have a high degree of morbidity and even mortality in coming off ECMO. If we could take and attach this lung, or we have an artificial lung that we've developed now specifically for infants, very high efficiency, very low resistance, and can be actually driven by the heart so that we attach it to the pulmonary artery. The right ventricle is the pump for blood to go through the artificial lung, and then it returns back to the left atrium.
It's sort of like, and not to get too inside baseball in the pediatric surgery here, but it's like you basically drive blood through the oxygenator of the ECMO circuit using the right ventricle as a pump.
So it's a wearable artificial lung, much like you've heard of artificial hearts and so on. It's a wearable artificial lung. And we're also developing some of the same things for adults. But in my case, my main interest is in doing so for infants and children.
Yeah, that's just amazing stuff. I mean, I think back to that movie, The Abyss.
The Abyss, yes.
Yeah, I'm sure you hear this all the time, but this is that. This is like, it's an old movie from the 80s. If you haven't seen it, it's amazing about things happening at the bottom of the ocean and divers who, instead of breathing gas, breathe liquid. And that's happening at the University of Michigan in real time. So,
yes. So, I mean, in some ways, it takes the reality of liquid ventilation and makes it sci-fi. And there is an underlying reality that breathing liquids is for many reasons, because you can control the gas content around diving, and also because we can keep the lung inflated under adverse conditions and even lavage the lungs, it can be very effective.
Yeah, just amazing stuff. And really sort of represents sort of the absolute forefront, I think, in incredible innovation in the future of surgery and the future of taking care of these patients. And then your talk today actually sort of focused on the other end, the intern and the medical student, you know, coming into training, and how do you make a surgeon who's simply competent to do what we know how to do today? And so maybe we'll focus a little bit on that. You talked a lot in your talk about research around work hours, which I think every surgeon out there knows is a major point of contention today, how work hours have decreased from, you said, 25,000 hours when you were a resident to about 19,000 hours now. And now I guess the question is sort of, A, what do we do about work hours going forward? And B, how do we use that 19,000 hours more effectively?
Yeah, so there are sort of three things that have happened. One is the work hours, which if you calculate it from the time when I trained to the time now, we have decreased about a year and a half in training. If you look at the 80-hour work week, you know, it's a year and a half.
And it half depends
what your
weeks, yeah.
What your denominator is there. And there's no doubt that because of the work hours, which there are many appropriate aspects of work hours, but the first study has brought to light, and other studies have brought to light, some of the aspects of the work hours and the fact that the impetus for them may not be completely valid. Not, there are many, many aspects of why we went to those work hours. Some of them are absolutely right. Some of them may not be, in fact. And how do we balance appropriate work hours with excellence in training and making sure the gaps in training are alleviated to some degree? The second thing is that there's been a change in surgery and the amount of operating and complex operating that we've seen that I did when I was a resident fellow. Some of that has gone to other technology and other approaches. And the third thing is the autonomy, for a variety of reasons, because of expectations around quality, because of compliance, and because now attendings are always present and always feel responsible, and appropriately so, but also that erodes into the independence and development of judgment and autonomy of training residents. And it means that then when they are finished, that aspect of their training has taken somewhat of a, you know, a decrease. If you have autonomy, then you develop experience and judgment. And in many ways, the pendulum has swung to the point where the autonomy and that development of judgment has been eroded.
Yeah. You make the point about, you know, everyone talks now, I think, sort of become common parlance, this 10,000 hours idea that with 10,000 hours of practice, you can develop real expertise. And you say, well, okay, great. We used to have 25,000 hours. Now we have 19,000 hours. That's still 9,000 hours more than 10,000 hours. But I was really struck by your calculations about how much of that time is actually spent operating.
Right. And so really the number of hours is about half that, somewhere in that ballpark, depending whether it's at general surgery level or it's at the pediatric surgery level. And so we don't really attain that. And it depends how much you believe in the 10,000 hours. But even so, the fact is that we think of training as being such a long period of time, but the percentage of time, the proportion that we actually spend in the operating room perfecting and developing those skills is actually a relative fraction, and more so in the first 5 years. So the calculations that I did show that the average general surgeon did 970, let's call it 1,000 cases in the first 5 years, and then 1,000 cases in the next 2 years. So those first 5 years really are diluted out moderately. Granted, there is a lot to learn. You know, both pre- and post-operative care needs to be in there, but we probably are not teaching as efficiently as we could.
Yeah, I think you pegged it at, what, 12% of your time as a general surgery resident you're actually operating,
right?
Which is seems low. I don't know.
Yeah.
Just qualitatively. Yeah. When I think about work hours, you know, having recently completed training, you know, it certainly felt like, you know, we worked a lot. Clearly, people before us worked more. It certainly felt like the time that we spent was often useful and often you were learning things, but it didn't feel necessarily completely efficient in the way that we were learning, in the way that particularly in learning complex tasks was really hit and miss. I mean, I think about, you know, all the residents in my program and fellowship, you know, where cases are rare, you can, you know, five people going through the same residency emerge with completely different educations, kind of depending on what came in when they were on. And one thing you talk about is how to maybe standardize that and build competencies using things like simulation and things like that, because I do feel like there's so much variation in our training.
Right. And not only that, but one of the points that I like to make is that in surgery, we teach cases and we don't teach skill sets. And if you take a pianist and they have a difficult piece, you know, there's parts that are easy and parts are difficult, and they concentrate on the difficult parts and again and again and again and again and again until they get that piece right. And then they put it in the context of the rest of it. And in surgery, what we do is we say, okay, today I'm going to do a Whipple procedure. And we, you know, of the hours that it takes to do that case, there are parts of it that are pretty routine. And then we incorporate the parts that are difficult. But wouldn't it be great if we could simulate or in some way have what we call deliberate practice? That is, to be able to say, okay, I'm going to do the pancreatic anastomosis again and again and again, because that's the most difficult part of it, you know, or whatever that may be in a given operation. So, for instance, duodenal atresia, the difficult part is setting up the anastomosis and performing the anastomosis. So if you could simulate that, which there are actually Kathy Barsness and Lurie Children's in Chicago has done a great job of coming up with a great simulation using calf. It turns out the calf has more than one stomach, and it looks just like a duodenal atresia.
Yeah.
And so using that, you could take that calf tissue, and you can practice that again and again and again. And then when you go to the patient, then you have your incision, and you have your mobilization, and you have your exposure, and you have that. But the laparoscopic part of actually doing the anastomosis, which from a laparoscopic point of view is the most difficult part of the operation, you can practice again and again and again in a separate setting and then bring that into the rest of the operation.
Right. This idea of moving from, you know, quantity of education to quality of education, I think, is so important, and finding ways to focus on those core things that don't depend on you having the duodenal atresia, you know, come in when you're on call, or, you know, not be taken by the other fellow, or, you know, whatever it is, that providing that opportunity to learn. I guess in my mind, that's kind of what's different. You know, people always say, like, surgery, you know, why can't it be like the way we train pilots or nuclear engineers or other things where there's complex tasks that don't require living in a hospital every other night for 5 years? And it's because we don't have the technology to simulate that experience in a predictable 9-to-5 schedule. I mean, that and the fact that, you know, William Halstead was sort of a coke fiend, manic depressive, if you, you know, read the history, and like maybe came up with kind of a weird idea about apprenticeship that we've stuck with. But, you know, that notwithstanding, the way that we learn is not quite the way that medicine works, and trying to find that balance, you know, what's the optimal way to learn versus, you know, what's the reality of how patients come through the door?
Right. Yeah. So, I mean, I think that maybe we can learn from the airline industry. My understanding that nobody ever lands at an airport without having done that landing in a simulator. But be that as it may, the bottom line is that you can incorporate simulation. And I believe, and in fact, I strongly believe that simulation is only going to get better. And the fidelity of the simulation is going to be such that it will be able to really simulate the skill set so that we can practice the skill set, so that we can then take that skill set and put it into the clinical setting. And I think that will address some of what you're suggesting, and that is that, first off, it'll standardize education so that everybody has those skill sets and won't be as highly variable and episodic. The cases will still be, but at least the training will be more standardized.
Yeah. You make the case that that's sort of a bedrock element to the other thing you talk a lot about in the talk, which is developing autonomy so that, you know, rather than being signed off on having spent 5 years doing general surgery, you'd be signed off on having these skill sets. And then potentially even during your residency or fellowship, you could actually begin to, having been certified with these skill sets, act autonomously.
So the whole concept around competency-based training is that you have a set of skills. One of the terms used for this is entrustable professional activities, or EPAs, which really are just a set of skills that you now say, we trust you to carry them out. And in the past, all of our training has been time-based. So you will do 5 years. And at the end of that 5 years, you are now a general surgeon. Well, you know, not everybody learns at the same rate and adopts the skills that are necessary over the same time period. And some may take longer, some may take shorter. It turns out that most of the data suggests that if you approach it from a competency-based point of view, that it's actually shorter, that it takes less time, because you allow people to learn in advance at their own pace.
Sort of incentivizes it too, I think, right? Like if you know that you could move through faster if you just got better. Yeah.
It does. And again, as you mentioned before, it standardizes the education and ensures that everybody has the skill sets that are necessary. The concept is that when you're ready, when you have the skills, then you will now be moved to the next level, which is an attending, which is certification and so on, rather than a time period. And after that time period, okay, you've done 5 years of general surgery, you've done 2 years of pediatric surgery, you're now a pediatric surgeon. Instead, it would be when you reach this level of skill set, then you are now ready to move into that attending position.
Wow. Just a fascinating view of the future of training for surgeons today, and then tomorrow, a fascinating view in the future of perfusion and ventilation. Really, like, your visit here is sort of offering us a glimpse into what I think is a really exciting future for trainees and for the practice of surgery. So thank you so much for joining us here in Madison and also for joining us on the podcast.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
We hope you enjoyed this episode. Join us next time when we hear from Dr. Ronald Mayer. He's a trauma surgery legend who's visiting from the University of Washington. Our guest host, Daniel Abbott, will be sitting down with Dr. Mayer, and the two will be discussing the importance of mentorship in the medical field and the impacts it can have on a medical career.
To be a mentor means to put the mentee ahead of yourself. It's more, what can I do for you today? And it's so important to provide the mentee what they need. Some people need to be pushed. Some people need to be protected. Some people need to be gently prodded.
The Surgery Set is a production of the Department of Surgery at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. This episode was produced by Rebecca Wazileski and myself. It was audio engineered by Chris Hansen and edited by Alex Worley. Our theme song is On Wisconsin, arranged and produced by Jamie Schmidt. I encourage you to visit us at surgery.wisc.edu, where you can find links to Grand Rounds, free CME credits, and more. You can also check out the UW School of Medicine and Public Health Video Library for a wide range of medical education resources at videos.med.wisc.edu. In addition, you can subscribe to this podcast on iTunes or Stitcher. And of course, you can follow us on social media. You can like our Facebook page and also find us on Twitter at Wisc Surgery, as well as me at J.E. Kohler. Please feel free to let us know how we're doing, and especially let us know if there are topics you'd like us to cover. Thanks, and we hope you check back soon.